understand the voices.
Every creature deserves to live a life in that promised Garden of Eden. The chickens, the turkeys, the pigs, and the cows. All of them have a right to live their lives free from cruelty, free from the harsh conditions that factory farming imposes on these wonderful members of the animal kingdom. Yes, and if you've been reading the papers recently, you'll see that there is a growing consensus that factory farming or concentrated animal feeding operations, that it is indeed morally wrong. Fortunately, there are alternatives, including eating a vegan diet or buying animal products only from producers who allow their animals to go outside and live a minimally decent life. All over the world, loving people are challenging the blatant injustices towards animals, especially factory farmed animals. Factory farming of animals is, to my mind, a blatant injustice towards innocent animals. Our radio program, Animal Voices, we hope offers a glimpse into a world that has systematically been hidden from public view. You're listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, also known as Co-op Radio. My name is Carl Loskin. Alan Jensen, thank you for being our technician. Marge Adam is our co-host. John Pranger is taking your calls. And in today's program, shortly we'll be speaking with Dr. Joyce Poole, the director of Elephant Voices, elephantvoices.org, based in Norway. And she's an eminent elephant field biologist. It ties well with our theme of the day, of our fundraising theme, which is untying the elephant. At 12:35, Eric Hammerum will discuss animal experimentation and how, as an 18-year-old, while living in Denmark, he experienced how one elderly person protesting animal laboratories alleviated animal suffering in laboratories. So it shows you what one person can do. And Marge, we have our guest on the line, but maybe you just tell us what you'll be doing today.
Yes, I have an interesting article further to what Carl has just said about factory farming, and even talks about the immediate area around our city of Vancouver. And then I want to tell you about the progress of the exotic pet legislation for the province of British Columbia.
Thank you, Marge, for your contribution, which will be later on in the program. For thousands of years, people have praised and punished, elevated and degraded, revered and feared elephants. Now the Earth's largest living land mammals is under threat, and with a host, and together with a host of ecosystems that are under threat. The destruction of elephants and their habitats has annihilated entire populations and pushed others close to the brink of extinction. Furthermore, the regular exploitation and abuse of individual elephants is a source of preventable suffering. Dr. Joyce Poole is a director of elephantvoices.org, a wonderful webpage, elephantvoices.org, and is an eminent elephant field biologist. And she's calling us from Norway today. Welcome to Animal Voices, Dr. Joyce Poole.
Thank you, Carl. Can you hear me?
Yes, I do. I hear you clearly.
And, well, that's good.
Yeah. So, you know, elephants are unique in so many ways, even their physique and the size of them and everything. Maybe you can just tell us how you find them to be particularly unique as a species.
Well, of course, you just have to look at them to know they're pretty unique. I mean, with a nose that is almost as high as they.
Oh dear.
Oh.
They're pretty Alan. Unique, but they're very intelligent. They have, as the saying goes, they have extraordinary long-term memories. They have very complex social structure. They live in matriarchal families and extended families and clans. And So they have a very complex social organization, actually quite similar to humans.
Well, maybe you can accentuate those similarities that elephants have with humans.
Well, a lot of their behavior, they're not just born sort of knowing what to do. They have to learn a lot of their behavior by watching older animals, for instance, what to eat, how to look after baby elephants, and so on. So, yeah, they are very complex. But going back to their families, in a way, they live in what we call a fission-fusion society. In other words, they live in families, and yet those family members are not together all the time. Somewhat like human families, members of the family come and go, and they use very powerful calls in order to stay in touch with one another. So when the family splits up, they're able to use these long-distance calls that have contained frequencies below the level of human hearing. They send these powerful messages and are able to then stay in touch with one another over long distances.
Now, Joyce, Dr. Joyce Poole, you did your PhD with the rutting, which is called a must, M-U-S-T-H, and which is very unique because, as you said previously, it is a matriarchal society, and that would really appeal to our feminists in our audience.
It is a matriarchal society. The young males leave their families at about 14 years old, and when they're in their, well, late teens, even late 20s, they start coming into a period of sexual activity that is known as must. It comes from the Urdu word, which means intoxicated. The males become very aggressive, very active. They sort of leave their bull groups and start searching for females. They have fights with other males. And when they first come into must, in their late teens or late 20s, they only stay in must for a couple of days at a time. But as they get older, they may stay in must for up to 3 or 4 months. When they're in must, they secrete from the temporal glands, which are located behind the eyes, and they dribble urine continuously. So they leave a trail of very strong-smelling urine, and that's a kind of a statement that they are ready for business, so to speak.
Now, when the male elephants are intoxicated with their hormones and the must, what would happen then if the females are not receptive?
Well, if the females aren't receptive, the males, you know, they go from group to group, and they test each female. they use their trunks to test the urine and to test the female's genitals. And if she doesn't smell interesting, they just move to the next one.
Right.
If a female is receptive, then she behaves in a different way. She looks over her shoulder. She acts kind of coy. Starts moving away from him, and then he will start pursuing her. But it's when a female's receptive, that it lasts for 4 to 6 days, and during the peak receptivity, then she's guarded by one of these males in must, and she'll be most likely mated by a male who's in his 40s or 50s.
Now, how long would the pregnancy of the female elephant be? And how long does it last?
22 and a half months. So the gestation is 22 and a half months. And then on top of that, a female will nurse a calf for 4 years. And then she will look after the calf, you know, until it's an adult. For females, they stay with their mothers for the rest of their lives. So it's a lot of investment in an elephant calf. So it's quite important that you choose your mate wisely. So that's why female elephants tend to choose the older males who who've proved that they're healthy and proved that they're dominant, and therefore, you know, they themselves will produce strong, healthy calves.
Now, with my calculations, it shows that the female elephant would only have a relationship or be receptive about 2 years after she's had a calf, or 2 or 3 years. How does that work?
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, females will come into what we could say become receptive or come into estrus.
Right.
Sometimes as early as a year and a half after they've had a calf, but often it's more like 2 years. So the interbirth interval is about 4 years.
Now, Dr. Joyce Poole, you did your PhD by studying in Kenya and on the savannas, and you must have spent quite a bit of time in that wonderful country. And maybe you can just tell us something about your experiences with observing them. And I mean, they're not always, as you mentioned before, that the bulls can get pretty difficult at the times when they're interested in the females and wouldn't tolerate humans or even cars driving around. You must have had some wonderful experiences. Maybe you can just share that with us.
Well, in the early days, when I was 18, 19, 20, and a bit of a novice, I wasn't as good as I am now at reading elephant body language, and I did get myself into quite a few tight spots with the musk males. I also used to drive a little two-stroke Suzuki, which had a habit of the plugs always oiling, so it was then often running on only a couple of plugs. And so I had a couple of close calls where I barely escaped from an elephant named Bad Bull. And that's pretty frightening. But, we got to understand each other. They learned that I was not trying to mate with their females, or that I was just doing my own thing. And we became pretty good friends. All the musk males knew who I was after some time and allowed me to work among them. But I always tried to keep my car facing in a direction where I could get away in going forward and not in reverse.
So you had an exit strategy with a bad bull.
Yeah.
It's nothing political with the elections coming up in the United States. But is it true that the elephants, when they're angry, they spread their ears absolutely like sideways, wide?
Perpendicular.
Is that correct?
Well, we have one of the body postures is ear called ear spreading, and that's a threat. But it isn't a particularly serious threat. I mean, that's the sort of first level. And then after ear spreading comes ear folding. And then you know it's a little bit more serious.
What do you mean by ear folding? Ear folding.
Well, if you imagine the ear of an elephant like, say, a piece of paper, and then you were to fold that piece of paper.
Okay.
A ridge forms across the center of the ear, and that's what we call ear folding. So when they're getting really annoyed, then they fold their ears.
Now, elephants are unique because they have a trunk, and it's an incredibly sensitive trunk. I mean, when they're feeding, they wrap the grass around the with their trunk and put it in their mouths, but it has many different functions.
Oh, yes. And they use it, of course, for drinking. They suck the water into the trunk and then pour into their mouth. They use it for smelling, of course, and you can really, by watching the tip of an elephant's trunk, is really, in a way, a window into the mind, because wherever they're trunk is facing is an indication of where their focus is. And of course, as you say, they use the trunk for feeding, and each species of different plants, they have a different technique.
Right.
So, for instance, they may, as you say, wrap their trunk around the grass and pull it. They may then shake the grass on their foot or on their tuft to get rid of the dirt, or they may scrape it on the underside of their trunk and so on. And, of course, they use the trunk to interact with other elephants, to take care of babies, and so on.
Right. Now, there's some myths about elephants, and maybe you can put us right in that. One of them is that they go back to die. They go back to a sort of an elephant burial place. And the other one is maybe you can talk about their legendary memories. So maybe you can comment on those two.
Yeah, yes, they've always talked about the elephant graveyard, and it's hard to know exactly where that stems from. It may be that when an elephant is unwell, it's sick, it's aging, it will tend to go to a place where there's water nearby and plenty of good food, so it doesn't have to travel very far. And so it is true that in those sorts of areas you can get an accumulation of elephant skeletons. It may also have come from the fact that early man in some places have pushed groups of elephants over cliffs and so on. But other than that, there is no truth to an elephant graveyard. But it is true that elephants seem to have an understanding of death. They have a very kind of special and unusual relationship or interaction with the bones of other elephants, and they can tell the difference between elephant bones and the bones of other animals. And when they come across the bones of elephants, they stop and investigate those bones, smelling them, touching with them with their hind feet, picking the bones up, carrying them off, and so on. So it is quite extraordinary.
We are talking to Dr. Joyce Poole, and she's the director of elephantvoices.org. We recommend that people go to their webpage, and there's a wonderful little slot there where it says donate, and that's always very welcome for all the wonderful work she does. Dr. Joyce Poole, I wonder if you could just hold on for maybe 30 seconds or so. We need to do a station ID, and it's also our semi-annual fundraiser. So is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
And when we come back, we'll talk about the environment and, of course, the ivory trade. So over to you, Alan. Thank you for being a voice for Co-op Radio.
Oh, thank you. And this is a really interesting discussion, and I'm waiting forward to getting back to it and learning more about African elephants, which is one of the sorts of things you can learn about and hear about on this program on Co-op Radio on the Animal Voices show, which comes to you every week. It's just one of dozens and dozens of programs that come to you every week here on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, listener-sponsored radio. Co-op Radio is sponsored by you, is supported by its memberships. We don't get money from big business. We don't have advertising. We don't get money from big government. We get money from you, the listener, and so twice a year we go on the air for a few days and ask you to call in, make a pledge, and support Co-op Radio. 684-8494 is the phone number. If you're out of town, area code 604, 684-8494. And take out a membership, make a donation, subscribe to Co-op Radio. It's your radio station. It's community radio. You can pay by Visa or MasterCard. The people in the phone room will explain to you all the details. I'll just quickly mention we have a couple of great books as an incentive for you to call in. We've got one called Stain Upon the Sea, which is about West Coast salmon farming, which is contributed to by a lot of people, including David Suzuki, Terry Glavin, and Alexandra Morton. Also, we have a great book with a foreword by Jane Goodall called Building an Ark, written by Ethan Smith with Guy Dauncey, and that's 101 Solutions to Animal Suffering. And you can have one of those books if you'd like, but the important thing is for you to call and join us, join Co-op Radio, become a part of community radio, and keep it on the air for another year. It's essentially important because you are where the money comes from. 684-8494. And so go to your phone, make a call, quick call, and keep one ear to the radio, one ear to the phone, and I'll send it back to Carl so he can continue more talking to Joyce Poole with his great stuff about elephants.
Yes, sir. We're very privileged to have Dr. Joyce Poole online from Norway, calling all the way from Norway, and she is a eminent elephant field biologist and a director of elephantvoices.org. And many of our programs are listed on our webpage. So this program will be posted on our webpage, animalvoices.org. And welcome back, Dr. Joyce Poole.
And, thank you.
And my co-host Marge Adams has a question for you.
Yes, Dr. Poole, before we get too far removed from the reproduction of elephants, I would like to ask you, does the male elephant play any role in caring for the young?
No.
No.
Oh, dear.
Too bad.
Not even when they're youngsters. You know, the young females, even by age 2 or 3, they're starting to look after newborn calves, but not the young males.
I see. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And that makes me wonder more about the social family ties amongst elephants. Clearly the females basically are a social group, but how is it organized? Is there the oldest female of the group is the dominant member? Is there competition amongst older females to be the dominant person, dominant elephant, and so on?
Well, you know, each elephant's family is really unique. And the relationships between members of the family really vary depending on personality, and a lot particularly on the personality of the matriarch. So the matriarch is usually the oldest and largest adult female. And a lot of people talk about her sort of being the boss and sort of pushing everyone else around. That's not been my experience, but it may be different in different populations where there's more competition for resources. But in the place where I've worked, in Amboseli, the matriarch really is a sort of a very pivotal figure, especially when the family is under any kind of threat. So if they suddenly find themselves facing a predator, then everyone will turn and pay attention to what the matriarch does and follow her lead. But on other days, anyone in the family can suggest a course of action. For instance, if one member of the family wants to go a certain direction, she might suggest